Well, good evening, everyone. This is Lou Caverly. You're listening to the Divided Kingdom Show. Well, here it is, the end of July. Summer is passing. And the weather is hot here in Maryland. I imagine many of you listening, it's the same. Well, what's happening in the world these days? Well, we got some good headlines here tonight. I want to mention, too, that some of you had written to me that you had concerns about the archives, and I hadn't been checking it closely, just assumed they were going okay on our website, but then I found out they were not, and I think we have it fixed now. So if you go to our website, DividedKingdomRadio.com, I think you will find that the archives are now in good shape. This program should be up and running by Saturday, I would think. And again, the website is DividedKingdomRadio.com. So I want to thank those of you who have written to me and tipped me off that things were not quite what they should be. Also, one of the things on our website is past shows. And depending on whether you use a computer or to access the website, DividedKingdomRadio.com, or if you use a smartphone, I know with my smartphone, there's a little menu at the top, and you can hit on that, and you'll see, among other things, you'll see the archives, and you'll see the access to the past shows. Well, the past shows, since Elizabeth's death, I really haven't kept that up, and I confess that it's gotten out of hand, but I have, over the past week or two, tried to get down to business here, summarizing each of the shows for the past 2 months at least. And I'm going to have those put in by our web mistress, Angel. She'll get those up as soon as I get them to her. And hopefully I will do that before you hear this program. So that kind of brings things up to date. If you want to write to me, we could always use a little donation. Still got a few books, COVID and Coming Chaos, if you would like one of those free books. Write to me, Lou Caverly, and that's spelled C-A-V-E-R-L-Y, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And if you didn't have a pencil or paper handy, I'll get that address to you again a little bit later. Let's read, got my tongue tied there. Let's lead off with this one here from Fox News. This is pretty current here, published July 28th, 2025. Senator Rand Paul says there are 186 billion reasons why we must audit the Fed. And the subtitle says Federal Reserve pays hundreds of billions to banks while operating at a loss and increasing national debt. And this again is by Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul. And he's been campaigning to have the Fed audited for quite some time now. So here's what the article says. The Federal Reserve, or the Fed for short, is a behemoth agency with the ability to manipulate and control the entire American economy. Our jobs, our finances, our savings, and ultimately our livelihoods, all of them are subject to the decisions made at the Fed. But the Fed's deliberations and operations happen behind closed doors. It's time for us to know how the Fed makes its decisions. Congress must take immediate steps to provide transparency for the American people. No other institution has so much unchecked power. Look no further than the unlimited authority the Fed used in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The Fed printed money, purchased government-backed securities, and doled out massive amounts of money to favored industries. These actions added almost $5 trillion. That's trillion with a T-R. $5 trillion in debt to the Fed's balance sheet. The push to audit the Fed has become bipartisan, and there is new legislation that would do just that. To be clear, representatives of the Fed are only interested in transparency to the extent it gives them political cover. Because, to them, the opacity of the Fed is a feature, not a bug. and their leadership considers secrecy to be a great asset. If you ask them, accountability to the American people and to the taxpayers who prop up their financial house of cards is actually bad. From the Fed's perspective, to even question this arrangement is in some way harmful or dangerous. Our country is now over $37 trillion in debt. Not enough people in Washington are willing to say no, because they don't want to stop spending other people's money, the other people being future generations of Americans who are defenseless against the voices of the present as they ask for tomorrow's money today. The Fed owns a share of responsibility for this, as their machinations and manipulations help perpetuate this unsustainable state of affairs, but with increasing difficulty each year. No one pays attention to the hundreds of billions of dollars the Fed unnecessarily paid to banks to not lend money to customers. For nearly a century, the Fed paid no interest to banks for holding Federal Reserves in those banks' deposit boxes. But all that changed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. Paying interest to banks for holding Fed funds was originally intended to control inflation. And from 2008 to 2016, the interest rate on reserves was a paltry 0.25%, and annual payments averaged $5 billion. But the situation quickly became dramatically different. Today's interest rate is over 4%, and consequently, the Fed subsidy to banks skyrocketed. And I'll just interject, this is Liz speaking, that means it's over 16 times what it used to be, the interest rate charged to the Fed. Going on now, to be clear, what this means is that the Fed has paid hundreds of billions of dollars to banks for not lending money to customers. In 2022, the Fed paid nearly $60 billion to banks. In 2023, the Fed payments to banks rose to over $176 billion. And in 2024, the Fed subsidy to banks rose to above $186 billion. And 44% of these subsidies are paid to foreign banks. To get worse, or it gets worse, the Fed is not profitable and hasn't been profitable for several years. In fact, I, and this is Rand Paul speaking, have argued that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Leviathan agency that infamously receives funding from the Fed, should be shut down because the Fed has been operating at a loss since 2022. One of the major reasons the Fed has continued to operate at a loss is because of its economically illiterate commitment to making these interest payments, which are entirely discretionary and not required. The Fed has authority to reinstate reserve balance requirements and ensure banks would not be entitled to these interest payments. In the meantime, the Fed is choosing through its policies to make its losses worse than they need to be. While the Fed no longer has profits and has ceased returning any profits to the taxpayers by remitting those funds to the Treasury, it has nonetheless paid hundreds of billions of dollars to banks. Meanwhile, the country's largest banks receive the bulk of the Fed payments. Although it's hard to say who and how much, because all of that is a secret kept hidden by the Fed. And it may only be the tip of the iceberg. Taxpayers need to know why the Fed can't afford policies that benefit them, but can afford hundreds of billions in bank payouts. The good news is that I, and that's Rand Paul, am leading the charge against the Fed's mismanagement and secrecy, and our ranks are growing. Azuria CEO James Fischbach weighs in on Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell's widely criticized move to not lower rates. On July 21st, I introduced the End the Fed's Big Bank Bailout Act, which would terminate the Federal Reserve subsidy to big and foreign banks by prohibiting the payment of interest on reserve balances. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders' support of this legislation indicates the broad appeal of ending easy profits for banks at the expense of taxpayers. Well, I'm going to stop right there. There's a little bit more to the article. But again, this is by Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, U.S. Senator. And the article was from Fox News on July 28th, if you want to research it further. Now, let's jump to something in the sort of in the health topic. This is from the People's Voice by Neam Harris on July 27th. U.S. birth rates have dropped to the lowest level ever recorded. The birth rate in the United States just dropped to the lowest level ever recorded, according to the CDC. The total fertility rate has fallen to 1.6, which is below the replacement level of 2.1 needed to maintain a stable population. This has all sorts of implications for the future, and in time, if things continue, will lead to demographic collapse. The declining birth rate could lead to a shrinking population and an aging workforce, which could have significant economic and social consequences. InfoWars reports, for instance, if we don't produce enough offspring, there simply will not be enough workers to support Social Security and Medicare, and those programs will inevitably collapse. A society with lots of old people and relatively few young people will result in poverty for everyone. So the truth is that the birth rate crisis is going to ultimately affect all of us. In order for the population of our nation to remain perfectly stable, women need to be giving birth to an average of 2.1 children, because not all children make it to adulthood. Sadly, the birth rate in the U.S. is now way below replacement level. The CDC just announced that the birth rate in the U.S. fell below 1.6 children per woman in 2024. As our society is not growing, our society is dying. If you go back to the early 1960s, our birth rate was hovering around 3.5 children per woman. But it's been on a downward trend ever since. And they give some facts here. I'll skip over those. But basically, by 2023, the rate was 1.621, and it inched down in 2024 to 1.599. So that's what they're getting the 1.6 from, rounding it off. So what has caused such a dramatic shift? According to CBS News, on average, U.S. women are waiting longer to have children, and many are choosing never to have children at all. The U.S. was once among only a few developed countries with a rate that ensured each generation had enough children to replace itself, about 2.1 kids per woman. But it's been sliding in America for close to two decades, as more women are waiting longer to have children or never taking that step at all. And again, this is author Neam Harris speaking. I think that it is important to also point out that many couples simply can't have children today. Infertility has been steadily rising among women, and among men, sperm counts have been falling precipitously since the 1970s. If we don't do something about this, eventually most males will simply be unable to produce offspring at all. For couples that are able to produce babies, many are putting off parenthood due to the rising cost of living. Most Americans are just barely scraping by from month to month these days, and having a child is really expensive. And this is Lou speaking now. This next set of facts is something that shocked me. Elizabeth and I, due to various reasons, did not have children. But listen to this. Raising a child from birth to age 18 in the United States can cost between $200,000 and $310,000, according to some sources. It's even pricier in some states, including Massachusetts, where families can spend up to $650,000 per child. Child care is a huge part of this. Parents can expect to pay anywhere from $3,000 to $21,000 annually on child care. When I, and again, the I here is the author of this article, Neam Harris. When I was growing up, my father worked and my mother stayed home with the kids. But that is very rare in America today. Most women are working. And that is another reason why the birth rate has been falling. It is just very difficult to have a full-time career and to be a full-time mother. This shift includes the fact that most women in high-income countries now work, while it was previously, quote, reasonable to consider having children as a widespread priority for women, unquote. But they do not attribute this to whether women work at all after they are married or have had their first child, but rather the tension between a lifetime career and the way motherhood interrupts or alters that lifetime career progression. But even women that don't work are having fewer children. So how do we explain that? The answer is very simple. Throughout human history, children have been considered to be a blessing, to be cherished. But our culture regards them as a burden to be avoided. We have a very me-centered culture, and we now prioritize ourselves over everything else. The idea of making sacrifices for your family and your children is anathema in this day and age. Young people are frequently told that they will, quote, ruin their lives, unquote, if they get married too early or have children too early. Our society encourages them to run around and have lots of fun before they, quote, settle down, unquote. Of course, many are choosing not to settle down at all. Our movies, our television shows, and our music glorify the single lifestyle. As a result, a higher percentage of Americans are single than ever before. But has that made us happier? No. We have a raging loneliness epidemic in the country that I've written about on numerous occasions. So those are the key ideas of that article. I'm going to skip down a little bit, just read a couple highlights here. If trends continue on their present path, demographers warn there won't be enough people to work to support society. The extreme labor shortages would lead to stagnation, poverty, and ultimately, in the most dire scenarios, the collapse of civilization itself. And the author, Neam Harris, says, of course, I don't believe that our society actually has enough time left for such a scenario to play out. We are committing societal suicide in so many other ways, and the clock is ticking. That was from the People's Voice. U.S. birth rates have dropped to lowest level ever recorded, July 27th, 2025. All right, we'll switch gears again. This time over to Slate News. More than two-thirds of Americans believe Biden's open border was a deliberate policy. This one's from by Nick R. Hamilton, July 25th, 2025. The vast majority of Americans believe former President Joe Biden intentionally left the borders wide open during his tenure, a recent Harvard-Harris survey has found. These results come as President Donald Trump makes significant headway in combating illegal immigration, Breitbart reported. During the Biden administration, record numbers of illegal aliens crossed the border. While it's possible that this was due to complacency or incompetence, a significant majority of those surveyed believe it was intentional. In a poll conducted from July 6th to 8th among 2,044 registered voters, 67% of respondents believe that Biden kept the border open. On whether or not this was a deliberate policy, 69% agreed that it was. This sentiment is more widespread when broken down by party affiliation, with 84% of Republicans believing it was a purposeful decision to keep the borders open, while 68% of independents share the same view. So even with the independents, I'll insert that it's above two-thirds. Even Democrats could only muster a slight majority of 51% who believed the border was, quote-unquote, secure, and 52% who thought it was, quote, not deliberate, unquote. Biden and his handlers were squarely responsible for the open border mess. And again, we'll skip down a little bit in the interest of time. Trump has plugged up the leaks in the southern border, with May and June reporting that there were zero illegal aliens brought into the interior of the U.S. I will skip down and have a few comments by the president. For example, he says, the evidence is massive and overwhelming. A special prosecutor must be appointed. Biden was grossly incompetent, and the 2020 election was a total fraud. This cannot be allowed to happen again in the United States of America. Let the work begin. And those are the words of Donald Trump. All right, let me skip down a bit more. According to Fox News, Biden paroled 27,766 illegals in June 2024, while Trump released exactly zero in June of this year. Trump's policies have also stopped illegal immigration at the source, as Border Patrol reported just 6,070 encounters with illegal immigrants for the entire month of June. During the Biden administration, there were as many as 10,000 illegal immigrants a day crossing the border. And we'll stop there for that one, but that gives you all the highlights. Again, that was from Slate News. More than two-thirds of Americans believe Biden's open border was a deliberate policy. And that was on July 25th. Do you want to look it up and get the details? Now we switch to some medical news. First, we have from LifeSite News, Representative Gosar reintroduces bill to add vaccine manufacturer protections from injury lawsuits. This was by Calvin Freeberger, again from LifeSite News, Friday, July 25th, 2025. Republican U.S. Representative Paul Gosar of Arizona reintroduced legislation that would end pharmaceutical companies' shield against liability for any potential harmful effects of the vaccines they manufacture. Gosar said, according to KAWC, I believe that's a radio station or TV station, quote, big drug companies are making huge profits while people who are hurt by vaccines can't get justice in court, unquote. To change that, H.R. 4668 is meant to, quote, amend the Public Health Service Act to end the liability shield for vaccine manufacturers, unquote. The current text has not been officially published, but it's expected to be substantially similar to the version he introduced last year that would allow individuals to, quote, bring a civil action against a vaccine administrator or manufacturer in a state or federal court for damages arising from such injury or death, unquote. This would eliminate the general immunity vaccine manufacturers enjoy under the federal National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986 and allow for civil actions to be pursued regardless of whether a victim has filed a petition with the program. According to details provided to Children's Health Defense, the bill would also remove the statute of limitations for individuals seeking compensation under the previous law, and eliminate the COVID-19 vaccine's classification as, quote, countermeasures, unquote, under the Federal Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness, or PREP Act, of 2005. Skipping down a little bit, there is a large body of evidence against the COVID vaccines, which were developed in record time by the first Trump administration's Operation Warp Speed initiative. The Federal Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS, reports 38,709 deaths, 221,030 hospitalizations, 22,331 heart attacks, and 28,966 myocarditis and pericarditis cases as of June 27th, among other ailments. And the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC researchers, have recognized a, quote, high verification rate of reports of myocarditis to VAERS after mRNA-based COVID-19 vaccination, unquote, leading to the conclusion that, quote, underreporting is more likely than overreporting, unquote. And I'll interject now, this is me, Lou speaking, that Elizabeth, when she was alive, and I often quoted to you the fact that fares vastly understates the adverse effects of the vaccine, so-called vaccine, because many people, if the adverse effects are not too severe, don't go to all the work required to fill out all the paperwork to report it. And they may not even know there is such a thing if they're living in an area that doesn't, well, what's the word? Let it be known that they can make such a claim by theirs. They probably wouldn't do it. They wouldn't know how. Or they might say the paperwork involved is just too elaborate, too lengthy, so they'll skip it. So although VAERS reported 38,709 deaths, I suspect it's far higher than that. And that, of course, is just in the U.S., not worldwide. Skipping down a little bit, an analysis of 99 million people across 8 countries published in the journal Vaccine, quote, observed significantly higher rates or risks of myocarditis following the first, second, and third doses, unquote, of mRNA-based COVID vaccines, as well as signs of increased risk of pericarditis, Guillain-Barré syndrome, and cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, and other, quote, potential safety signals that require further investigation, unquote. In April 2024, the CDC was forced to release by court order 780,000 previously undisclosed reports of serious adverse reactions. And a study out of Japan found, quote, statistically significant increases, unquote, in cancer deaths after third doses of mRNA-based COVID-19 vaccines, and offered several theories for a causal link. And this is Lou again, I'll just interject. When they say statistically significant increases, what they mean is that it goes well beyond what you would expect from mere chance, that there does seem to be a definite tie-in that these statistics point to as at least a, if not a cause-effect, at least something that where the two things are related, the vaccine injections and these various illnesses. In January, a long-awaited Florida grand jury report on the COVID vaccine manufacturers found that while only a minuscule percentage of the millions of vaccinations resulted in a serious harm based on the data it had access to, such events do occur, and there are, quote, profound and serious issues, unquote, in pharmaceutical companies' review process, including reluctance to share what evidence of adverse events they did find. And in May, U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA Commissioner Monty McCary, and Vaccine Chief Dr. Vinay Prasad announced that there would no longer be blanket recommendations for all Americans to receive the shot, but the risk factors that would still be recommended for included asthma, cancer, cerebrovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, and a bunch of others that I won't bother to read. Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. subsequently announced COVID vaccines would not be recommended to healthy children or pregnant women. All right, I'm going to stop there, but you get the general idea that all through the pandemic, the so-called vaccines were that the manufacturers, distributors were exempt from any kind of liability, unless it could be proved, which is very hard to do, that there was willful deceit going on. And that is a very hard thing to establish in a court of law. So, in essence, the vaccine companies were scot-free. And if they got sloppy and put things in those vaccines, as they may well have done, that were very harmful, there was no recourse by the victims. Once again, that article, if you want to read all the details, go to LifeSite News for Friday, July 25th, 2025. And the title of the article is Representative Gosar Reintroduces Bill to End Vaccine Manufacturer Protections from Injury lawsuits. So I would definitely, if you're in favor of that, contact that representative, and he is a representative from Arizona. Well, once again, if you would like to visit our website, the archives are now, as far as I can tell, up and running just fine. So you can hear past programs, including just about all the programs. So one or two repeats I had to do shortly after Elizabeth's death. But I think I've had a new program every week for at least the last 2.5, probably 3 months at least. So you can hear any of those. And I will very soon get the descriptions where it says past shows on the website, the descriptions of what those past shows included in an abbreviated form. Should be up and running in a day or two. And again, it's DividedKingdomRadio.com is the website, DividedKingdomRadio.com. And we would love to get your letters. I guess I should say now, sadly, Elizabeth is no longer with us. She went to be with the Lord in February, as most of you now know. And so I'll say, I love to get your letters. If you'd like to write to me, Lou Caverly, and you spell that C-A-V-E-R-L-Y, just write to Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, just like the Bible, Bethlehem, Maryland, and the zip is 21609. That's Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And, of course, we can always use a little help. It costs us at least $600 a month to put the program on. And we've had several very consistent, very loyal listeners who have helped us out immensely. But the last month or two, it's gone down some. We've been able to get enough to keep the program going, but just barely. So if you could help a little bit, it would be greatly, greatly appreciated. Now, I'm going to go back to Slay News on a little different topic. School district forced to apologize, pay $20,000 after suspending student for saying illegal aliens. This one is from by David Linfield, L-I-N-D-F-I-E-L-D, Dateline July 24th, 2025. A North Carolina school district has been ordered to admit its mistake, publicly apologize, and pay $20,000 after being sued for suspending a 16-year-old student for using the term illegal aliens during a class discussion. The legal battle, which lasted for a year, was finally settled on Tuesday in the U.S. District Court for the Middle District of North Carolina, marking a victory for the student's First Amendment rights. The lawsuit was filed after Davidson County Schools suspended Christian McGee in April 2023 for asking, and now I'm interjecting this as Lou speaking, listen to this quote and see if you think this is such a terrible thing. The student asked, quote, do you mean space aliens or illegal aliens who need green cards, unquote. And that was during an English class discussion. Now, again, this is Lou speaking. That seems to me like a reasonable statement. You hear the term illegal aliens many times on the radio, TV. Some Democrats and some left-wingers prefer the term undocumented aliens, but they are illegal. They have broken the law. So illegal aliens is a perfectly reasonable statement or description. Now back to the article. Although the student was making a simple point about the language being used in the debate, the school deemed his comment racially insensitive, resulting in a 3-day suspension and marks indicating, quote, racially insensitive behavior, unquote, on his permanent records. The case got the attention of President Donald Trump. Trump sent a personal recommendation letter to McGee as he seeks an athletic scholarship in the future. According to the Liberty Justice Center, which helped with the litigation, McGee's fight for free speech has sparked broader conversation about First Amendment rights in public schools. In addition to the $20,000 payment, the settlement requires Davidson County schools to issue a public apology to McGee, remove the, quote, racially insensitive, unquote, marks from his records, and acknowledge that the school's response to the incident was inappropriate. However, as stated in the court order, the settlement does not amount to an admission of liability or wrongdoing. Sarah Parshall Perry, Vice President and Legal Fellow at Defending Education, emphasized the significance of the case, saying, quote, as the Supreme Court has often reminded us in its First Amendment jurisprudence, students do not shed their free speech rights at the schoolhouse gate, unquote. Perry also criticized the current state of education, noting how, quote, many educators have become lost in the wake of the previous administration's identity politics obsession, unquote. Perry's comments reflect the broader concern that public schools are increasingly prioritizing political correctness over constitutional rights. And Ms. Perry continued, quote, the mission of American education is rooted in the viewpoint diversity of a pluralistic society. And she continued expressing hope that the outcome of this case would remind schools to respect students' free speech rights. The case also brought attention to how McGee's mother defended her son, including attending school board meetings to voice her concerns. The Liberty Justice Center alleges that two members of the board retaliated by sharing her arrest record with county leaders and residents, encouraging them to spread it on social media. This settlement sends a strong message to public schools. Students' constitutional rights must be respected, and educators should think twice before infringing on free speech for the sake of political correctness. Good article, and that was from Slate News, July 24th. School district forced to apologize, pay $20,000 after suspending student for saying illegal aliens. All right, I'm going to rearrange things slightly here. Here's something from the Washington Times. Christian photographer won't be prosecuted by New York for declining same-sex weddings. Where have we heard that controversy before? This is by Valerie Richardson, the Washington Times, Thursday, July 24th, 2025. Chalk up another win for Alliance Defending Freedom attorneys representing Christian business owners who draw the line at working same-sex weddings. New York Attorney General Letitia James entered into a settlement agreement that prevents her office from bringing anti-discrimination charges against wedding photographer Emily Carpenter and provides $225,000 in attorney's fees. The consent decree filed Tuesday came after a federal judge ruled in May that Ms. Carpenter was likely to prevail in her 2021 free speech lawsuit challenging New York laws barring discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And we have a quote here, free speech is for everyone. And we're pleased to settle this case so that Emily can speak her views on marriage without the threat of being punished by New York, unquote. Those are the words of ADF attorney, that is Alliance Defending Freedom, senior counsel Brian Nehat, in a statement he gave out. Ms. Carpenter's legal prospects weren't always so rosy. In December 2021, U.S. District Judge Frank Geraci dismissed her pre-enforcement challenge, ruling that the state has a, quote, compelling interest, unquote, to ensure that people have equal access to public goods and services regardless of sexual orientation. He took her case to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, but before the court could rule, the Supreme Court decided in favor of 303 Creative owner Laurie Smith, saying in its majority, 2023 majority opinion, that the state couldn't compel individuals to express messages through created content with which they disagree. ADF attorneys represented Ms. Smith, a Christian website designer in Colorado, as well as Masterpiece Cake Shop owner Jack Phillips, whose 2018 victory at the Supreme Court laid the groundwork for the 303 creative decision. As a result, the appeals court sent Ms. Carpenter's case back to the lower court, where Judge Geraci found that it is, quote, now beyond debate that a state's public accommodation law may not be applied to expressively make that too expressive activity to compel speech, unquote. And I'm going to skip down once again. The consent decree prevents the New York Attorney General and New York State Commissioner of Human Rights from enforcing laws against Ms. Carpenter that would require her to offer same-sex couples the same wedding and engagement services available to opposite-sex couples. Ms. Carpenter will also be allowed to state her policies and beliefs on weddings on her website and social media accounts without fear of prosecution. The consent decree applies only to Ms. Carpenter and her business and expires whenever she stops offering, quote, paid wedding photography services to the general public, unquote. Even so, the federal court's rationale would be expected to cover other New York photographers who seek the same protection. And skipping down once again just a little, here's a good reason why this is important. It says the photographer based in Elmira, New York, in the southern part of the state, had reason to be concerned. Violations of the state's human rights law carry penalties of up to $100,000 in fines and a year in jail, as well as the loss of a business license. And Ms. Carpenter stated it's $100,000 fines, it's jail time, it's ultimately the closure of my business. And as an entrepreneur, that's extremely terrifying. And she posted that on the ADF website. And ADF is, Alliance Defending Freedom. And Ms. Carpenter was also represented by legal counsel Raymond Daig of Daig Law. So that was in the Washington Times on July 24th, 2025. Christian photographer won't be prosecuted, etc. All right. Now, haven't talked very much about the Second Amendment in a while. Here's something from Fox News. Federal appeals court rules California ammunition background checks unconstitutional. Circuit Judge Sandra Acuda said the law, quote, meaningfully constrains, unquote, the right to keep and bear arms. This is by Landon Mion of Fox News, July 25th, 2025. A federal appeals court ruled Thursday that California's first-of-its-kind law requiring gun owners to undergo background checks to purchase ammunition is unconstitutional, declaring that it violates the Second Amendment right to bear arms. In a 2-to-1 decision, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a lower court judge's permanent injunction blocking the state from enforcing the law. Circuit Judge Sandra Acuda said the law meaningfully constrains the right to keep and bear arms, and that the state failed to prove the law was consistent with the country's historical tradition of firearms regulation, as required under a 2022 U.S. Supreme Court decision, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. And Judge Acuda wrote, by subjecting Californians to background checks for all ammunition purchases, California's ammunition background check regime infringes on the fundamental right to keep and bear arms. And this is the loose speaking now. Of course, the left-wingers like Governor Gavin Newsom said, oh, the ruling was a slap in the face. Those were his exact words to efforts by the California officials to restrict firearms, to curb gun violence. All right, I'm going to skip over some of their comments. It says the judge can ask an 11-judge appeals court, or the state, rather, can ask an 11-judge federal appeals court or the U.S. Supreme Court to review the decision. The plaintiffs included Kim Rhode, R-H-O-D-E, who has won 3 Olympic gold medals in shooting events, and the California Rifle and Pistol Association. The gun group's president and general counsel said in a joint statement that the decision was a victory against, quote, overreaching government gun control, unquote, while Rhode described it as a, quote, big win for all gun owners in California. All right, it gives a little of the background. The original injunction against having the ammunition, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll stop there in the interest of time. Once again, you can read the whole thing at Fox News, July 25th, 2025. Federal Appeals Court rules California ammunition background checks unconstitutional. All right. Another matter for a Christian mother from LifeSite News, Friday, July 25th. Christian mother allowed to adopt children in Oregon after refusing to affirm LGBT identities. The summary says a Christian mother scored a victory in federal court after she refused to encourage gender confusion and homosexuality in minors. The Alliance Defending Freedom, that's, you'll notice that's that same organization, hailed the decision as a, quote, huge win. This, I don't know if I said it, was by Matt Lamb. In a huge win for religious freedom, a Christian mother of five can begin adopting children in the state of Oregon. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled Thursday in favor of Jessica Bates, a, quote, devout Christian and widowed mother of five, unquote, who rejects gender ideology. Bates wants to begin the process of adopting children, but objected to the state's requirement that parents unconditionally accept a child's assertions about his or her gender or sexual inclinations. The court ruled that Bates can continue the process of adopting while her lawsuit works its way through the system. The Three Circuit panel explained how the First Amendment protection of speech and religion supported Bates' case. And here we have a quote. Fundamental as basic freedoms, these rights spring from a common constitutional principle that the government may not insist upon our adherence to state-favored orthodoxies, whether of a religious or political variety. Those are the words of Judge Daniel Bress, writing along with Judge Michael Hawkins. Judge Richard Clifton dissented. Oregon's restrictions, quote, quite clearly restricts and compels speech based on both content and viewpoint, the two judges conclude in the majority opinion. And they give some more words there, but I'll skip down a little bit. The case drew national interest with conservative think tanks, religious groups, and Republican attorneys general defending the rights of Bates to follow her faith by raising children. Liberal groups lined up in opposition. And let's see now. ADF Senior Counsel and Vice President of Litigation Strategy, Jonathan Scruggs, stated in a news release, quote, every child deserves a loving home, and children suffer when the government excludes people of faith from the adoption and foster system. Jessica is a caring mom of five who is now free to adopt after Oregon officials excluded her because of a common sense belief that a girl cannot become a boy or vice versa. And Scruggs went on, because caregivers like Jessica cannot promote Oregon's dangerous gender ideology to young kids and take them to events like pride parades, the state considers them to be unfit parents. That is false and incredibly dangerous, needlessly depriving kids opportunities to find a loving home, he said. The Ninth Circuit was right to remind Oregon that the foster and adoption system is supposed to serve the best interest of children, not the state's ideological crusade, unquote. It says more on this excellent ruling in our press release, and it gives the website there for that. And Jessica, it says, ADF President Kristen Wagner also voiced her support for the ruling. She said, quote, huge win at the Ninth Circuit for our client Jessica Bates. And she wrote that on X. She went on, this widowed Oregon mom was categorically barred from adopting a foster child, regardless of the child's age or beliefs, because she wouldn't promise to affirm gender ideology, unquote. Wagner said this is a persistent problem, as her Christian legal nonprofit is challenging similar laws in Vermont and Washington. And she said, we pray this case will lead to more victories for children and families. And there's a little bit more. You can read the whole thing at LifeSite News, dated July 25th this year. Christian mother allowed to adopt children in Oregon after refusing to affirm LGBT identities. And then we have, from the Washington Times, Trump administration's anti-Semitism agreement with Columbia sets template for higher ed. This is by Valerie Richardson, the Washington Times, Thursday, July 24th, 2024. Columbia University may soon be $221 million poorer, but its decision to sign a resolution agreeing with the Trump administration, agreement with the Trump administration, has provided a model for academic institutions seeking to regain their federal funding by uprooting campus anti-Semitism. In the 22-page settlement, Columbia agreed to pay $200 million to settle, quote, claims related to discriminatory practices, unquote, and $21 million to a fund to resolve civil rights cases filed by Jewish employees with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. A White House fact sheet stated, this is also the largest ever settlement for victims of anti-Semitism and for workers of any religion, unquote. And going down a little bit, the agreement addressed concerns about intellectual freedom and the politicization of the academy by stressing that the administration would not, quote, dictate faculty hiring, university hiring, admissions decisions, or the content of academic speech. Education Secretary Linda McMahon hailed the agreement as a, quote, roadmap for elite universities that wish to regain the confidence of the American public. And former Harvard President Lawrence Summers called the deal an excellent template for agreements with other institutions, including Harvard, which has rejected the Trump administration's overtures. Well, it goes on at some length here. Skipping down, the Anti-Defamation League praised the deal as an, quote, important next step in fighting anti-Semitism and hate on the campus, along with restoring federal funding needed for critical research. Brian Cohen, executive director of the Columbia Barnard Hillel Kraft Center for Jewish Life, said the resolution recognizes that, quote, anti-Semitism at Columbia is real, and it has had a tangible impact on Jewish students' sense of safety and belonging, and in turn, their civil rights. This is not the end of the process. However, it is a major step forward, Mr. Cohen said on X. And, of course, some of your left wingers like Jerry Nadler, New York Democrat, accused Columbia of caving in to the Trump administration. But I don't put a great deal of stock on what Jerry Nadler has to say. And it goes on for a couple more pages, but our time is running short, so let me just give you a couple of the highlights. The author says Columbia has shown that it means business. The day before the agreement was announced, the Columbia University Judicial Board punished nearly 80 students with expulsions, 1 to 3 year suspensions, and degree revocations for their involvement in disruptive pro-Palestinian demonstrations, the Columbia Spectator reported. The agreement was signed by Ms. McMahon, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert Kennedy, Jr., Attorney General Pam Bondi, and Acting Columbia President Claire Shipman. And it says Ms. Shipman stressed that the university would retain control over its academic and operational spheres, our, quote, North Star, unquote. But Columbia officials had to face facts about the threatened loss of federal funding. And she said in a statement, quote, we have seen not only $400 million in federal grants frozen, but also the majority of our $1.3 billion a year in federal funding placed on hold, she said in a statement. The prospect of that continuing indefinitely, along with the potential loss of top scientists, would jeopardize our status as a world-leading research institution, unquote. And some others thought it was a win for Columbia because it would keep some of their freedom to do some of the things they want to do. Well, I'll stop there. It is a, well, the article does go on for a ways more, and I've skipped over a few things. So if you'd like to read the whole of it, just go to the Washington Times website. It's by Valerie Richardson. The date was July 24th, just a few days ago. And it says, Trump administration's anti-Semitism agreement with Columbia sets template for higher ed. I'm shocked. Now, this is Lou giving my own opinion. This is just my opinion. I could be wrong about it. But when they say the federal government gives Columbia, what did they say now? The Columbia president talked about $400 million in federal grants. Said our $1.3 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars a year in federal funding. Why does a private college need that funding? That's taxpayer money going for an elite university. To me, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Maybe I'm just a poor boy who's a little jealous of the rich ones, but somehow, to me, using taxpayer money to fund programs at a private university is, I don't know, just rubs me the wrong way. I'll leave it at that. Well, we've got some other good articles. I've got some things I didn't get to today. Our intrepid contact up in Massachusetts has a bunch of things that I'll go over next week on the illegal immigration up there. Oh, I used those words, didn't I? Illegal immigration. They're going to suspend me from school, I guess. There's also an article here. Some of you may have heard some of this on news, Fox News in particular. Hillary Clinton sounded alarm on Biden's political viability by 2024, Ron Klain told the House investigators. Well, our time has run out for today. If you'd like to write to me, the address is Lou Caraballi, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. Thanks for listening. Be sure and tune in again next week. Good night.